Well, unless you're more polar bear than human, chances are that living in Wisconsin at some point in the year, you're going to need to heat your home. Most of us inherit a heating system when we buy a house, but it's good to know what the options are and when it might make sense to convert to a different system. Even though it's still summer right now, it's a good time to be thinking ahead to the heating season. And we have two guys with us today that know a lot about that and about much more. John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates in Fitchburg is here. Good to see you, John.
Great to be back.
And Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison is his partner for these programs, probably in crime as well, that they do every other month. Thanks for spending time with us today, Ken.
Really nice to see you.
So let's talk about heating. I mean, it seems so funny to be talking about this in August, but, you know, things change quickly here in Wisconsin. We have nothing if not extreme ups and downs of temperatures. And I think it's a really good time to talk about heating because it's going to be coming. What percentage of U.S. homes have central heating?
Almost 97% have. Wow. That is actually higher than I thought it would be. But there are 3% still out there with wood stoves.
Or no heating at all.
Well, a few years ago, I visited a friend of mine who lived in a place with an outhouse and a wood-burning stove, and that's what they lived in. So
there you go.
That
so
was
that's
kind
part
of,
the 3%. Well, so looking at those almost 97% of the houses that have central air, what are they using to provide the energy for that central air, John? Or
well,
central heat, sorry.
The central heat nationwide, 50% of them use natural gas and 35% electricity. Oil, especially in New England, is another 6%, and 9% are on heat pumps at this point. Now, the South, of course, is very different than the North, but if we look at the Midwest, we're much more gas-dependent, 69%. But surprisingly, we have 18% electrically heated houses in the Midwest, 2% oil, and only 2% in heat pumps.
And so you said that nationally, they're 9% using heat pumps, but only 2% using them in the Midwest. Why do you think there's that difference?
The traditional heat pump has been an air source heat pump. So basically, it is an air conditioner, and of course, it's used for air conditioning as well, with a reverse switch. So it can scavenge heat out of the air or release heat into the air. Now, in the South, where it doesn't get that cold, you're okay. In Wisconsin, if you have an air source heat pump, it probably has a backup electric coil or you have electric heat in your house because at some point, at 25 below zero, there's just nothing to scavenge.
And so let's back up just a little bit. When we talk about heat pumps, what kind of equipment are we talking about exactly, Ken?
Well, when we talk about heat pumps, you had mentioned the geothermal as one type or even air-to-air heat pumps. And what they work off of two principles. The first principle is basically compressing some material to raise the temperature. And they both work that way. In a geo system, you have a big circulatory system in the ground, and that warms the air to the ground temperature. And then compresses it. And then you have the second principle, which is that heat always moves from, you know, from hot to cold. So if you're holding a cold cup of water in your hand, it gets warm as the heat transfers from your hand to the cup of water. Those are the two principles. So it's a little bit more complicated than that, but basically you've got a circulatory system that goes in the ground. Most of them are closed loop in the ground, and they circulate a material that's an antifreeze and water solution. And then they have a compressor that compresses it. Then they have a way to transfer that heat to an air coil, an air handler, basically. And then you circulate them throughout the house, either with an air handler, or you can also do it with radiators and that sort of thing. Same with an air system. An air system is like your air conditioner on the side of your house. Mm-hmm. The heat pump version of an air conditioner on the side of your house reverses its motor and actually works exactly the opposite. It takes the heat out of your house, or it takes the heat out of the air outside and brings it into your house in cold weather.
Mm, okay.
The big problem with that is that, like John said, when the temperature is very, very variable, I guess. The temperature is variable, so you can't always rely on it. And when it gets down to lower temperatures, then you get ice buildup, and then you have a lot of little problems that can arise that don't arise with geo.
The nice thing about geo is the ground is usually the same temperature. Now, it's a little warmer in Florida than it is in northern Minnesota.
But it's very, very
it's constant.
Constant.
We figure about 55 degrees in most of the U.S., and it's certainly much easier to get heat out of something that's 55 degrees than something that's 25 below zero.
Mm-hmm. So with the geothermal, you're using that constant temperature to either make it cooler or make it warmer, but you're starting at a pretty temperate temperature. Mm-hmm. We're all about double words today. Temperate, a more temperate or more moderate temperature.
Exactly.
That you're starting from.
Moderate and constant.
So instead of going, trying to cool 90 degree air down to say 70 or warm 30 degree air up to 70, you're going, to and from 55 or so.
Well, what's interesting is that when you have a geo system that's working in the ground, your solution is warmed to roughly 55 degrees, as John said, and that when that material is compressed, it can get up to 150 degrees.
Wow.
So it's quite warm. There's another benefit I'll get into, or one of us will get into in a minute, and that's we can also heat your hot water using the geo system virtually almost for free.
Wow, because it's just kind of an add-on.
It's an add-on, yeah. Oh. Well, free, you buy the equipment.
right. Well, actually, we have a question from Christina in Ridgeland about geothermal, so let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I actually have two questions. I have a large equestrian center with a living area. The stall barn and the living area are heated with geothermal, which has proven to be very efficient and economical.
Mm-hmm.
One question is, from what I understand, I should be able to cool with that as well, and I'm not sure how to go about doing that. Is it just that the floor will be cold and that'll cool, or...
Oh, it's
or
an
in,
you have an in-floor system, is it what you're saying?
Hello?
Yeah, Christina? You have an in-floor system, is that what you're saying? She can't hear us, I think.
All right, I think we lost Christina.
In-floor system, yeah, basically when you reverse the system, you start drawing air out of the coils or drawing heat out of the coils, so you're actually cooling the floor a little bit.
Yeah, and that's not going to work in an equestrian situation because of the tremendously high humidity that you have from the expiration of horses. But what Christina could take a look at is to put in a separate air handler, because the other thing that you need in equestrian setups is you need about a 50% fresh air for any system. Right. So you need an air exchanger. So it can be done. She needs to talk to a good, knowledgeable contractor.
I didn't realize you had such a background in equestrian buildings.
I design equestrian buildings.
Wow.
He's got a lot of horse sense.
All right. Thank you for going that route and not another. We're talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger, general contractors today. We're starting out talking about heating, especially heat pumps and what the options are there. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And Rob Ferret, our on-air producer today. Dan and Toma also would like to talk about geothermal. So let's go there. Hi, Dan.
Good morning.
Go ahead. Hello? All right. I think we're having some problems with the phones right now. So let's just talk a little more about the efficiency of heat pumps. Our previous caller was saying that she's found it to be very effective and efficient for heating. What kind of, data do you have on that?
Well, we have mechanical efficiency, which is what we look at most of the time. And for air source heat pumps, generally the energy efficiency rating runs from about a 13 to a 17. Air conditioners in Wisconsin, the worst one you can sell in Wisconsin is a 12. So that's decent. But ground source is pretty surprising because the low end is a 16 and the high end, believe it or not, is a 30. So part of it, I think, has to do with the type of work the compressor has to do. As Ken was talking, the compressor can do more because we've got a standardized temperature, so we can get some pretty tremendous efficiencies. That really helps with the payback, and there's a huge efficiency difference, obviously, between air and ground source. If Ken currently had an air source heat pump in his house and he switched that to a ground source, he could probably pay that off in between 5 and 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you had a gas or oil furnace, it'd take about a decade in Wisconsin to recapture all that money. Ken, I know that Larry Mueller had you put in a system for his house.
We did.
Why don't you talk about that? Because there's one of the big issues with these is you need this big ground loop. How did you manage on Larry's small urban lot to be able to capture enough heat to heat his house?
Well, thanks for the question. So, that's a good point because people think of needing a very large acreage to run your ground loops. Sometimes up to an acre, I think people consider. But what we did, and what's happening more and more often in urban settings, is that we're picking a location. We picked in Larry's place underneath his driveway. So we took the driveway out, which is a concrete driveway. Fortunately, it was on its last leg anyway, so it needed to go. We dug 5 wells and put a plenum in and then ran into the house and then covered the whole thing back up with a new driveway. So underneath his driveway is a heating and cooling plant that's quietly working away. No exterior fans, no motors or anything like that. We're finding it to be very efficient. We did run into a little problem when we first set it up because we set up a storage tank for hot water. And this is interesting. You set up a storage tank just to collect the hot water that's produced as a byproduct of the heating process or cooling process of the geo plant, and the electrician actually wired it up by mistake as we used an electric hot water heater that was just meant to be a storage tank. And so we're heating the house off that hot water heater, so their first bill was like just enormously high. So we've worked out some of the details, some of the repairs on that, but now we've been monitoring it every month. And last month, for example, the typical house in Madison with our cooling days had 3 to 4, some close to $500 in cooling bills, and his was for their entire electrical, I think $130, and that was running air conditioning, running constantly, television set, refrigerators, mm-hmm. And so forth. So
just to go back to what you were saying, that you put all of this in under the driveway,
mm-hmm.
So. Going up to their house, you don't see any kind of mechanical things above ground. It's just connected into the house, and there's not any kind of like big compressor or anything.
No,
like
it's
that.
Not like a solar system, mm-hmm. where you see all these solar cells, mm-hmm. on the roof and lines coming down sometimes outside the wall. It's all underground, and then inside the basement, there's the compression unit, some of the other the air handler, and then a separate small gas powered furnace. That will only kick in if it gets to a temperature so low that the geo system can't keep up, and it hasn't really kicked in. Because we put a separate monitor to watch this very closely, and it hasn't. I don't think it's kicked in at all.
Wow. Yeah. Well, let's go back to the phones and Doug and Menasha next. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
All right. We are going to encourage people to send emails since the phone lines seem to be not working well. Sorry about that. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. You can also post a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're talking with general contractors Ken Adams and John Freiberger, starting out talking about ground source heat pumps and what kind of an option they can be. But we can certainly talk about other heating issues and possibly cooling as well, since we still have a little bit of summer left. Will in Kenosha asks, what are the pros and cons of self-venter water heaters as opposed to chimney vented? And can you vent the water heater out the same line as a furnace vented through the foundation?
There's tremendous difference in efficiency, Will, between the old chimney-vented water heater. We call them the self-cooling water heater. Now, some of them have a thermal damper so that when the burner's not on, it shuts off. But if you don't have that, that chimney is drawing air up through the water heater and out of your basement all year long, including in the winter. And that's cooling down the tank. They also don't have the kind of burners that we have on the side vented. The side vented uses an ID fan, an induced draft fan. And when that fan shuts off, it basically seals the system so that you are not getting all of this flow that is coming out. I would take a look at Focus on Energy and see what is available out there, but you're going to see a pretty tremendous change in your gas bill for the water heating portion of the gas bill. It cannot be vented out the same vent as the chimney. It has to be in a separate CPVC line, unless there's a manufacturer out there doing something new that I don't know about, but I'm 99% sure that that is correct.
All right. Thanks for that email. And let's go to Doug in Menasha. Hi, Doug.
Oh, hi. Yeah, you folks were talking earlier about benefits of geo versus air sourcing due to the moderate and, consistent temperature. But I think another major benefit has to do with the fact that, dirt, the ground, it's so much more dense than air that it can just hold so much more heat, either to take it out or to dump it back in,
mm-hmm.
Such to the point that the geo systems can run. I've read that they can run as much as half as much as a comparable air source system for cooling and like a third the cost for heating purposes.
Yeah, that's very true. That's a very good point. There's a lot of advantages of the geo over air-to-air thermal exchange systems, and that's a good one.
Yeah, it's like having a well that never runs dry.
Well, it is a little bit of a perpetual motion machine. Because it uses the natural, mm-hmm. Temperature of the earth. Another sort of benefit was in the summertime when it's taking the heat out of the house, even though the temperature of the ground is fairly constant, it does, over the course of the summer, warm it up very slightly. And so in the first part of the winter, as the ground is a little warmer, it actually adds to the efficiency of the heating system mm-hmm. at the beginning of the season, so it's kind of an added little attaboy.
And Doug, do you have a ground source heat system yourself?
No, unfortunately, I don't have enough exposed lot to try and sink anything in. It's mostly just building here, but I've looked into them a lot, and I love the idea. And if I could, I would jump on one in a second.
Well, maybe sometime in the future. And we talked about the fact that only 2% of Wisconsin or Midwest homes are using heat pumps. John, do you think that's going to increase in the future?
I think it will. The last year that I have data on from Department of Energy is 2009, and 100,000 heat pumps were sold that year, 60,000 in 2008. So we are seeing some large increases. I don't know by region. I can't remember mm-hmm. the figures of the DOE reported, but certainly we are seeing people moving towards them. Cost is a little bit of a factor,
but it helps though. There's some great tax incentives right now, John. Between the different incentives that are available, you can actually lower the cost by a third. Now, if you have a normal system that's say a conventional system that costs you $10,000 and a geothermal system that costs you $30,000. And you get a third off, you're only paying a $10,000 premium.
Right.
But the efficiencies of it really can pay off over time. I remember reading that you could, if you have a standard house, you can basically maybe invest $60 a month and more in your mortgage to pay for the system, but have $80 to $100 to $120 worth of savings paid back. So you're actually in the black right out of the blocks, as they say at the Olympics.
Well, I certainly agree with you, Ken. When you're looking at recovering your costs in 10 years, I mean, that's sort of as if somebody was offering you an insured savings bond at 10%, and I think we would all jump at that. But there is a pretty substantial initial cost. The figures I've seen is that for the ground source, it's anywhere, depending upon how easy the site is to work and how good the equipment is, from 3,000 to over 5,000 a ton. What did Larry's, maybe I shouldn't ask what Larry, what did a typical Madison house owned by an unknown person cost?
Well, let's put it this way. I've been involved in systems that cost around 28,000. This is complete system, including ducting, zoning, the heat exchanger, the groundwork, everything. And I've also been involved in systems that are over 150,000. So, that's but
we won't ask where Larry falls in there.
No, he's on the low end. But I'm talking about a 9,000 square foot home with three stories very significant.
We're talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger, talking especially about ground source heat pumps right now and what the options are. You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234 or emailing us at talk@wpr.org. And let's go right back to the phones. Bill in Cottage Grove. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I've got a ground source heat pump. We built a new home about 5 years ago, the geothermal system. And we've got in-floor heat on the floor slab, and it costs us about $18 more last month than ordinary. And we're able to cool the house very well.
Mm-hmm.
I took a look at all my electric bills from 2 years ago, and my average electric bill was $51, and that includes my heating and my cooling. And all the electricity for a 1,920 square foot three bedroom home. I am absolutely sold on the geo system. Mine is fairly simple because it's, in floor heat on the slab.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm able to cool the house very well just by reversing the heat pump and turning on some ceiling fans.
Do you mind me asking about how much you invested in the system?
I've got about $16,000.
Okay, so it's a fairly simple system.
Yes, and mm-hmm. particularly, when you start out with a clean sheet of paper right from scratch, you can do a lot of things that are a lot handier.
Absolutely.
But one of the reasons I'm able to do all of this for that lower price is because I use off-peak electricity. I never have to heat my home in the daytime.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
because my home is so super insulated, I never have to cool my house during the daytime either. So then I'm just using off-peak electric rates to chill that floor in the evening or to heat the floor.
Well, this is Bill. Bill's the future. This is what's going to happen more and more often as our heating bills skyrocket. Mm-hmm. Right now, the cost of electric is artificially low, so it doesn't look quite as appealing, but that's not going to stay that way for much longer. It's only a matter of time. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a lot more people like Bill doing it. Thanks for your call, Bill. That was great. It was great information.
Thanks, Bill. And, let's talk just a little more about cost because, you gave a huge range there, Ken. Of course, it really depends. But I know that you're estimating things on a per ton basis, right, John? And what does that really mean?
Well, a ton is basically 12,000 BTUs. So an average house, not a super insulated one like Bill, but an average house might have a heat loss at 20 below zero of 60 to 80,000 BTUs. So you're looking at a 5 to 6 ton system for that.
Okay.
But as Bill rightly points out, there's a real big difference between retrofitting, which is the sort of thing Ken does so well, and designing brand new systems, which is something I do so well. The last one that I designed, the entire system, which was a slinky, so a fairly complicated ground loop where it's basically envision a slinky.
Aren't you a little old to be playing with slinkies?
Only really big slinkies. But we use the driveway again. We put the slinky in the ground. That costs a little extra money, but it did save on space on the lot because there were a lot of mature trees that he did not want damaged.
So basically, if you think of a slinky, it's a very tight coil, spring.
Right.
So you're getting – it's kind of like the human body fitting a whole lot of intestines and things in a small space by going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
You're getting a lot of ground contact per 100 square feet of lot that you're using. And this system, I believe, ran about 22,000 complete.
And we had a question from an email. Ken, does that system of putting it, say, under the driveway and in a really compact place like John's talking about, does that add to the cost of one of those systems?
Well, it only adds in the sense that you have to replace your driveway. So, okay. I mean, it works.
But the equipment itself,
the equipment itself isn't, it's not, it doesn't really affect the price. Maybe a small, one or two percentage points.
Okay. And let's go to Jim in Winnebago County next. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I have a new personal automotive shop that I have no heating or cooling in right now.
It's got 2 inches of styrofoam underneath the concrete floor. It's got 2 inches of closed cell foam in the walls and R40 insulation in the ceiling. I was all set to put an infrared system in, a propane-fired infrared system, and I was talking to somebody else who had a similar size shop with about the same insulation, and he said, we just took ours up because it was so doggone expensive to run, and we put a conventional system in. So I wonder if you could give me some advice on heating and cooling. I'll be out there periodically throughout the course of the summer and the winter, but this is obviously not some place where I live unless I get kicked out of the house.
Well, Jim, so this is not a professional auto shop. This is basically a hobby shop. It's your hobby shop, is that right?
That's exactly what
it is. Okay, so this is sort of a glorified, well-constructed garage.
You got it.
Okay, yeah. The choice of heating, now your walls are probably a bit under-insulated. You've got, if you have closed cell insulation, you've probably got R12 walls. By the time you add the sheathing, the siding, there may be R14. So your walls would probably benefit from doubling the amount of insulation, and the R40 is quite good for the attic, and the underslab sounds quite good. So you probably have a little more heat loss than you really need. One of the big questions that Ken and I always have when working on houses or working on hobby shops is indoor air quality. Infrared can really work pretty well because it's a radiant system. You feel warmer than the air is, and they can be relatively energy efficient if you buy a good one. But the problem is you don't have the air changes. And there you are with a little spilled gasoline. You've got some oil. You've got some vinyl cleaner. And we're not changing the air in there. So I would really think about indoor air quality and what you're doing there and probably go with a good quality 96%, 92% efficient condensing furnace so that you can dial in the air changes that you need. And if you talk to a contractor, you can actually set it up so you get different levels of air changes depending upon whether you're using volatile chemicals in there or not. So don't just think HVAC efficiency, but also think of indoor air quality.
Okay. All righty, I'll give it a try. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks for that, Jim. And especially if Jim ends up having to spend a night or two out there, we don't want him breathing that bad air.
That's my perfect house, a 10-car garage and a bathroom.
All right. Good to know. Well, let's go to Jeff and Stevens Point next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We're looking at building a house here soon in the future. And we're looking at a number of renewable energy options, including like passive solar and concrete construction. My questions here are, if we do in-floor heat, is there a way to do that in a house with a basement? I mean, can we heat the main floor that way? And also, are there other cooling options, I mean, in addition to the heat pump, to keep a renewable energy house cool in the summertime?
First of all, the first question, yes, absolutely, you can use in-floor heat to heat the a second floor above a basement. A couple things you'll want to do is you'll want to insulate underneath the floor so that your heating and cooling is going up rather than down, too. But when you ask a question about what can you do besides a heat pump to be energy efficient, I'm not exactly sure what your question is. John?
I'm not real sure. Jeff, why don't you re-ask the second part of that question?
I'm just looking for other renewable energy options for cooling a house besides a heat pump and besides a traditional air conditioner.
Well, I mean, one possibility would be nice if you want to keep it cool without using air conditioning. People use large and intelligently built overhangs with good ventilation, passive ventilation, sometimes fans. An efficient fan motor uses very little electricity, so you could supplement passive air movement that way.
Kind of the opposite of the passive solar that he's talking about to heat his house using different techniques to
move air through. And I mean, that's one way to think about it.
I've heard something referred to as a swamp cooler. Also, what does that do? Doesn't that kind of
if that's what I think you're talking about.
They use it a lot in Arizona and drier climates.
They work very well in very dry environments, but they don't really work that well in a place like Wisconsin.
Okay.
My dad had one in Colorado, and what it was they ran a water line up to the roof, was it? I think that's how it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then it sort of, I can't remember exactly how it was set up, but it was kind of slick for a dry environment. But
not so much for
here. But not for here, you know.
Yeah. I think it basically relied upon evaporative cooling, which is why they were located usually up on top of the roofs.
Right.
Okay. And in dry climates.
In dry climates, right.
Okay. All right. Thanks for that call, Jeff. And let's go to Ron in Sauk City. Hi, Ron.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I've got let's beat up Larry's lot a little bit more.
Okay, sure.
He's not here. We can talk about him.
Okay. I got a driveway that needs to be tore up. It's like 14 feet by 60. And I want to build a garage on the back, which is 24 by 24, which will tear up some more ground. But I live on a non-compliant building lot that is 60 by 100 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So I got 6,000 square feet of ground to work with. And guess what? The village won't let me get within 8 feet of a boundary line. But I'm thinking that they'd let me drill. So if I were to use all of that extra, that'd be 60 by 16 and my 24 by 24, and I'm about 250 feet from the Wisconsin River.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd probably have to go fairly deep to get below the water line.
Are you thinking with geo? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, you don't.
I'm 58 years old, and I'm hoping to live for another 20 years.
Well, I hope so too, at least.
Yeah. Well.
Well,
but,
first of all, the DNR gives approval. You have to have a DNR permit to be able to do any kind of a geo system, and depending on your village, usually they will look at the DNR permit. And say, okay, as long as you follow their guidelines, you'll be okay. We've done some things close to the water, and it should be just fine. These are closed-loop systems. You don't have to go below the water table. All you have to do is go down basically below the frost line, and your temperature should be fine. Because they're closed systems, it won't affect any... the water won't affect it. As a matter of fact, some geosystems are actually set into pools of water. If some people have a pond next to their house, that you could actually set the system in there underneath the line that's going to be a freeze line, basically. So, and then with regard to the location, you got plenty of room. I don't know how big your house is, but can you?
Well, technically, it qualifies. I read several articles in remodeling magazines.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It's a tiny house. It's less than 1,000 square feet.
Oh, so you may only need 3-4 wells, which means I think the wells need to be about 15 feet apart minimally, so they don't interfere with the heat changes. So don't quote me on that. It might be a few feet in either direction, but you got plenty of room.
It sounds like actually Ron has more room than he probably needs for that size of a house.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to have a problem. I'm just, you might have a problem siting your garage, but that's a different issue. And, good luck with that, with your dealing with your municipality.
Thanks for that call, Ron. And I just want to go back to something you said, Ken, that the Department of Natural Resources has to give their okay on a geothermal unit. Why is that, and how do they decide if it's an okay place to put a unit?
Well, they want to make sure that you're following their guidelines, which is that which has to do with how you disturb the soil. You're putting a well in. Anytime you put a well in, you have to have Department of Natural Resources take a look at it. These are dug the same way as a regular well. They're just two loops put in, a loop put in instead of a draw line. And then the other thing, they want to make sure that the chemicals in the cocktail that it's made out of is water and certain types of antifreeze, not necessarily to keep it from freezing, but to keep it consistent viscosity. And so, so that's the way it is. So it's a fairly benign process.
Mm-hmm.
They're really good to work with. They know what they're doing. And I have yet to see one submitted by a professional that knows how to design a geo system. I have yet to see one that's been red flagged.
Great. Thanks for that. And let's go to Shirley and Prentice next. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I think the man who called about the river near his house, the answer for him probably would take care of my question, too. I have a pond near the house, probably two-thirds of an acre, and I guess it's neither an advantage or a disadvantage, so I wouldn't have to worry about that. I'll ask a second question. Does this, if many, many people were using this type of geo heat and cooling, would it do anything to the environment, sucking all the heat out of the ground?
John, you want to take that?
Surely that heat is being replenished as we speak, simply by the decay of uranium, by compression, by gravity. So the Earth is heating itself from the inside out. So no matter what we did, we are never going to end up cooling down the Earth.
As a matter of fact, the big industrial geo-energy sources are tapping all the way down to magma layers to draw heat, to heat industrial applications. Mm-hmm. No study has shown that it's that we can overpower that anytime.
That's a great question, though, Shirley, and it kind of goes back to what you said, Ken, that it really is kind of a perpetual motion machine.
I don't want to go that far, but it there's so many upsides.
Yeah.
And that it just makes sense. I would be an advocate of the government saying, we're going to give you 100% tax credit on this if you change. And over time, it's going to just make such a big difference. You know, a typical house, 40 to 50% of our costs go into heating and cooling in it. You know, maybe 8 or 9% and refrigeration and so forth. You know, and then there's lighting and cooking and stuff.
Sure.
But if you can really dramatically drop that, I had read one thing that said over a 25-year period, the savings would be like not cutting down 120,000 trees. So that's a significant amount. Mm-hmm. So if you're not cutting down, I mean, if the heat that you're producing is not cutting down 120,000 trees, and the heat that John's producing is not cutting down, all of a sudden you've got a real strong argument for being environmentally friendly.
Right.
At not a huge, huge cost.
That's a really good point. And speaking of trees, Fred in Madison emailed, can you run a geothermal system on a forested lot?
Yes, you can. And depending upon the driveway, again, can be extremely useful, especially if you use a slinky type system, or you can use a well system. You're wanting to probably do a tree survey, get an idea from arborist. If you have specimen trees, 300-year-old oaks, you're going to want to know where the roots are going, type of oaks, that sort of thing. But a good forester working with a decent engineer should be able to design a system for you really quite easily.
Great. We are talking with Ken Adams and John Freiberger. They are general contractors in the Madison area. They come by every couple months to talk with us about home improvement and home repair. You can join in. The phones are full right now, but you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org or leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. We are talking about ground source heat pumps and what an interesting and efficient way they can be to heat and even cool our homes or other buildings. And let's go right to Paul in West Bend next. Hi, Paul.
Hi, good morning. The question I have is that we're using your soil as either as a heat sink or a heat extraction medium. And if you're in an urban setting with restricted land area, can you go vertically down, like, say, 40 feet, and do you have to analyze the soil profile? Because some soil, obviously, as you said, more dense, will hold more that latent heat.
Paul, that's a great question. And yes, these wells go, the wells that I was talking about in urban areas go straight down. They're not horizontal, which you can do if you have the acreage. But these go straight down, and they go down on average about 150 feet. So and loop around from there. So that should be fine. We were talking before about the DNR, and one thing I wanted to add to that is when you dig a well, you create a lot of mud, and so part of the permitting process is that you submit a plan for how you're going to deal with that mud.
Oh, okay.
So that's another reason that DNR is involved, and that's important in forests as well as in urban environment.
Great. Thanks for that call. And John in Cable is next. Hi, John.
Hello. We've had a geothermal system installed at our house last December, I guess it was. And the contractor that we hired used a horizontal boring machine. And so instead of going down vertically, they kind of go down into the ground at an angle, and they go down about 15 feet. And so they did like five runs like that, and the runs went right underneath our house. Underneath our garage.
Hmm.
And, no, you certainly can do that. There are a lot of horizontal boring machines out there. We see them all the time. No one digs up a road anymore. We use a horizontal bore and just shoot the gas pipes under them.
Yeah.
So certainly, as long as you're keeping your bores on your own property, so you don't have to get an easement from the neighbors, and you have enough land, that certainly is another way of doing it.
And so when they're horizontally done, how far down are they going before they go horizontal?
Generally, you want to go down a minimum of 10 feet.
Okay.
And it sounds like what John was saying, they went down about 15 and went horizontal, which is even better.
Mm-hmm. And so that's down 15 and then across instead of, as Ken, you were saying, going straight down 150.
Yep.
And as far as, you know, how long it takes to do something like that or the complexity, is one easier than the other?
I don't really think so. I think it just really matters how you can make it work for your property. That's the critical issue. Digging a well requires digging straight down. Mm-hmm. It's different equipment, but it works very similarly.
Okay. Tom emailed, what happens if you have a break in the geothermal line or problems with tree roots? Seems like that would be a major nightmare.
Well, it would be. The thing is, they use a material that's very flexible. It's John, do you know what it's sort of a polyethylene kind of material?
I believe it is, and I've always asked and said, how long is this going to last? And they say 80 to 100 years. Don't worry about it. You're going to be long dead.
And that's what they tell you, and I think the warranties on these are somewhere between 50 and 75 years. So it's not something to worry about in our lifetimes at this point. You know, maybe one day they might have to be dug up and reinstalled.
Well, and I'm also thinking, especially if you're putting it in as a system on a brand new house, you certainly hope the house is going to last that long and much longer.
Yeah.
So how do you plan for that? I mean, do you just assume that at some point you're going to have to replace parts of that system?
Well, and what you do is you map where it is. So we know where each well is. We know where each horizontal run would be, so that if there is an issue, that could be monitored from the house. If for some reason a pipe was punctured, which is very unlikely unless it happened in some sort of a construction mode,
mm-hmm.
But they're all tested before they're backfilled and so forth. So that helps eliminate that. But you can figure out which one has a problem, and you can eliminate that from the system and then decide how you're going to reevaluate how you're going to solve the problem. That's, you know, that I don't think it's really that formidable a problem. And also, in the chemicals that are used inside are basically benign. It's very important that there's very rigid limits on what they can use for the chemical that's inside. It's mostly water, but it's a little bit of, like I say, it's an antifreeze.
Okay. Well, actually, I think Kevin in Toma has a question that relates to that. Let's go there. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to pass along a comment. I read an interesting editorial in Fine Home Building Magazine a couple years ago, and what the author claimed was that if you're using the electric grid to power your geothermal, and that electricity is coming from a coal-fired plant, you may be actually responsible for releasing more carbon dioxide than you would if you had a high-efficiency gas furnace that's 96% or higher. So
okay.
I don't know if that's true, but it was just kind of a different point of view. He just wasn't sold on the end.
Okay.
That raises a good question.
Standpoint.
Yeah, let's see what John has
okay,
to say.
Okay, well, yeah, here comes the statistics guy.
Okay.
I would really want to see the statistics on that. Remember that furnaces use electricity, too. And even though furnaces are much more efficient than they used to be, they still are using electricity. Plus, we're using natural gas. Plus, we are pumping the natural gas. Pumping the natural gas requires electric pumps. So we have electricity tied in on either side. What we are not doing is we are not burning fossil fuels when we are using a ground source heat pump. And we may be burning some fossil fuels for the electricity, but anyone who's worried about that can simply take a look at their house's efficiency. Get rid of all those old incandescent lights. Make sure that your recessed cans are airtight and insulation contact. I mean, Ken has mentioned several times that a lot of this stuff is site-specific, and there's two sites. One is the site is your lot, and so maybe you can drill vertically, maybe you can drill horizontally, maybe use a slinky. But the other thing at your site is your house. As mm-hmm. Ken mentioned earlier, there are things like natural air conditioning, insulation levels. So you really need to combine the ground source heat pump with an efficient house mm-hmm. to make sure you minimize your footprint. But I would be extremely doubtful whether the fine home building facts were really correct.
Well, I just want to support that and say one thing that I read before the show, as a matter of fact, is that according to the Department of Energy, an efficient geothermal system in a residence that uses 3 to 4 tons, it's a small house, contribute 1 cubic foot less of carbon monoxide for every hour it's used.
Hmm. So that's pretty significant.
That's significant.
Yeah.
That's like, well, they use the analogy, that's converting 58,000 cars to zero, to a zero emission car. That's an amazing amount. So John's right on the money there.
And worth mentioning, Judith, one can go to the Department of Energy website and download a lot of papers and surveys on both geothermal and air source heat pumps.
Mm-hmm.
Look at payback studies. DOE is doing a great deal of work on this. There are also academic papers that are coming out where this is being studied as well.
Great. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Earl in Fond du Lac next. Hi, Earl.
Hi, and thanks for this program. I just wanted to share experience in Fond du Lac. In 2001, we built a new high school, and it probably is the largest school building in the state. It was an ideal location or a situation for geothermal because we had to install 12 acres of ponds for flood prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So in the 11 years the system has been operating, Alliant Utilities has estimated that it has saved about $1.5 million in energy costs compared to a comparable commercial size building built at about the same time.
That's fantastic information.
It is. And Earl, I think that this was one of the schools that was featured in articles either in the ASHRAE Journal or else it was in the Consulting Engineer Journal about the use of pond-sourced geothermal energy.
Hmm. It was, and kind of what was interesting in the planning, a few of us had asked about exploring the possibility, and the architect wasn't really familiar that it could be used in large buildings, and he felt that it wouldn't be appropriate at all, and then under further research that, yes, you can use it in any size building, so... I just think it is a great way for us to conserve our resources.
Yeah, thank you. That's good information.
Great to hear about projects like that.
You know, Epic Information Systems, the,
mm-hmm.
the company
in
Verona, they have, I want to say, maybe 7 or 8 very large buildings, and the entire place is heated with geothermal.
Really?
They also have some solar
that.
Arrays there, but they just put in a new field to support 2 more buildings. And... yeah, it's over time, it's going to really, really pay off.
Mm-hmm. We had a question on Facebook from Bob. Heat pumps take a lot of electricity. Is that figured into the equation for savings and efficiency?
Yes, it is. As far as the Department of Energy calculations that I've seen, again, if you go to the DOE website, you should be able to search around and pull some of those things up.
And Adam said, great show. I feel most air conditioning comfort is derived from dehumidification rather than low temperature. If these systems cool so efficiently and therefore run less, I imagine they leave more humidity in the air. Would that be true? Ken?
Well, that's an interesting question mm-hmm. because my experience is no, they haven't really, they don't really leave that much humidity in the system or in the house. but I don't really have any study to show what the actual difference mm-hmm. is.
I think he's right, though, that it's really the humidity level that kind of determines how we perceive the comfort level.
You could have it 78 in your house and humid and 78 and not humid, mm-hmm. and it'll feel like a completely different
right.
world.
Basically, dehumidification is a byproduct of air conditioning. It's not one of the primary things. So as long as your cooling coil temperature is the same with either geothermal or a standard air source, you're going to have the same amount of dehumidification. Mm-hmm. But people can also take a look at simply whole house dehumidification. I mean, there are people who don't like air conditioning. And I can understand that. With whole house dehumidification, you can control the humidity and worry a little bit less about the heat.
That's true.
Certainly on these houses where we have in-floor systems, there's always the problem of cooling that concrete or cooling that floor to the point where it becomes the first condensing surface. So on some of these houses, I think if we were designing a concrete slab, especially if people are putting carpet over it and they want cooling in there, we would probably also specify a house dehumidification system so they did not get condensation, and then get mold growth and things on the floor.
Mm-hmm. Is there an ideal kind of level for where you want your humidity?
Well, there certainly is in the winter in Wisconsin, and generally we say below 40.
Great. Ken Adams and John Freiberger are here until 12:30 talking about all things home improvement, especially ground source heat pumps, back after the news. It can certainly be stressful when something needs to be fixed at home and we don't have the time or maybe the money or the expertise to take care of it. But the first step is zeroing in on the problem and figuring out what needs to be done and whether it's a DIY project or time to call in the pros. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller today. Thanks for joining us. We're lucky to have two pros that know a lot and have a good time sharing their experience too. Ken Adams of Adams Design Construction in Madison is here. Great to have you back with us, Ken.
Oh, it's nice to be here.
And John Freiberger of Freiberger & Associates in Fitchburg is his partner for these programs. Always a pleasure, John.
Pleasure here, too.
Well, as is often the case, we have full phone lines, so I say we just go right back there and get some listeners on. Mike in Madison is up first. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
I've got an older add-on boiler, basically like a wood boiler, like a wood add-on furnace a lot of people put in the 70s. Well, what I did is I took that and ran some insulated PEX pipe into probably 40 feet to my house. I'm in a municipality on the east side, and they don't allow outdoor wood burners, but I put that in as an add-on furnace in my back garage, and so it's sort of my own little power plant, if you will, to make heat. My question is, how big would you think, or would I be have any advantages in putting in a bed type geothermal? I have excavation equipment available to me, so I could dig any square area X feet deep and put some tubing in. I'm just using a standard boiler circulating pump right now. And have you heard of any kind of heat pumps that sort of utilize glycol?
Ken?
Well, I guess I'm not entirely sure how to answer that, Mike. It sounds to me like you're in the municipality, in the city of Madison, and you're somewhere on the east side, and you've got a wood burner in your garage, but you'd like to eliminate it and install.
No,
okay.
No, I'm using it. I'm basically using it as an outdoor wood burner.
I see.
And so I guess maybe I should be saying it as a thermal bank, but try to gain, some advantages out of the sort of like if I heated with wood, I'd be heating that ground so that I wouldn't have to fire wood all the time. I would sort of be, maybe get into, I don't know.
Let's see what John has to say about that, Mike.
Okay. It is possible to design something, but I hate to tell you, you're going to need an engineer. And it's probably going to cost as much to do it. But what you're probably going to be looking at is you're going to be burying a very large tank. And depending upon the BTUs of storage, it may end up being a large insulated tank. And there are a couple of those here in Madison. What you would do then is you would have a pump system that would pick up heat from your wood stove. It would heat the water, keep that water warm, and then you would have a circulation. So it can be done. The cost on it, I think, is not going to be particularly advantageous to you. But it certainly is an interesting idea. I think if you do a little bit of online research, you will find some information on these. These are not unlike the pond systems, except that you are introducing energy from wood.
Mm-hmm. How these bed systems that you guys are, like you use either your wells for a typical home. Let's say I just went all geothermal and I, you know, got sick of cutting wood. How big of a bed might you need? And I know you like to go 15, 10, 15 feet. How big of a square footage for maybe a 2,200-square-foot home?
Well, Mike, again, that is really going to depend upon your thermal needs with the house. If you have an older house that's inefficient, the first place I would start is getting a good energy audit done on the house. Tighten everything up. Determine what your heat losses are, because the better your house is, the less heat you have to use, the smaller your system is going to be.
So what kind of a house are you living in, Mike? Is it older or newer, well-insulated?
It's actually it's a kit home, like a craftsman home, and it's I've got quite a bit of insulation, and it's all blown in the walls, and there's probably a good, 18 inches, some 2 foot in the ceiling of the attic. So it's insulated pretty well, low-E glass windows. I went through a major rehab
great.
In 2004.
That's great. So it's well-insulated.
I'm actually heating it with a 60,000 BTU air, just high efficiency furnace, which has got its hands full, but I knew I had insulated it well enough that it would handle it. But it's definitely it's a big house.
Okay.
Well, for a geothermal system, you're probably looking at about 5 tons, so you are probably looking at the low end of 18,000, at the high end probably 27,000. So quite a bit of money for a standard geothermal system. You may want to take a look at doing something with your wood system, but at some point we may find that wood-fired boilers and heaters are simply going to be banned in most urban areas because of air quality. Certainly we already have that out west.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, actually, thanks for that call, Mike. Mike's question reminds me that I wanted to make sure we talk about, we've been talking with folks that are starting fresh and, clean slate and can put in a ground source heat pump system. But we've also heard from people that would love to have one but have something else in place right now. What's involved in converting an existing system to a ground source heat pump system? Ken?
Well, the first thing that you want to do is you want to have, as John said a minute ago, have a high quality energy audit of your home. There's Focus on Energy usually has several people that they can recommend. Mm-hmm. You can check around to see who really knows a lot about your home and your envelope. Once you get that report, that should help decide what you need to do to your existing house. And then also with that, then we'll work with a heating contractor or a general contractor that can help design, like John designs these systems and can help size how many wells you need or how much horizontal run you need, what sort of slinky you need depending on your application. And then they dismantle your existing system as much as they need to reinstall the new system. If it's a forced air plant, often they can leave the ducts alone, and then they put in somewhere in the ducting dampers that are controlled electronically by this system, so that if you have zones, you can open and shut them. But the heat plant is completely different. It's a compressor. It's not a fire. It's not a fired unit. Some in rare instances, you can use your old furnace as a supplement, just on those 30 degree below days that your geo might not handle it. But energy audit, take care of the house envelope, work with an experienced geo engineer or contractor or heating contractor.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks for that. And you can join the conversation with Ken Adams and John Freiberger by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or leave a question or comment on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And David in Appleton is next. Hi, David.
Hi. I'm going to be replacing my roof. Home was built in 1983. And my question is, I currently have 6 box vents. And looking to go to ridge vents. I didn't realize that I need about 60 feet of ridge vents, and it's going to be about $550 for ridge vents. I didn't realize they were that expensive. Advantage, disadvantage between box vents and ridge vents?
John?
Ridge vents are much more efficient than a box vent because they're located at the high point of your roof, and that is where you really want to have the air exit. Now, David, one thing to check, you should probably go to a site like coravent.com, C-O-R-A-V-E-N-T.com, and also take a look at Wisconsin Uniform Dwelling Code on what you need for venting. You do not want to get more upper venting in than you have lower venting, or you'll have an unbalanced house. You can have more lower than upper. This is all spelled out very clearly in the Uniform Dwelling Code, which you can access online, and make sure that this is well planned out. For some reason, we've had a whole spate of home inspections where the roofers have come in and they've put these marvelous ridge vents on the house, and the houses have no soffit vents because they're older houses. So the attics, as we say, suck. And they're pulling, in the winter, they are pulling air out of the house through
literally
every light fixture, up around the
wow.
chimney, and every other place. And the attics are getting very wet, and the attics are in worse shape, being overvented by too much ridge vent than they were when they were undervented.
Wow.
So look at it as a system. This is really easy to do between CoreVent and the Uniform Dwelling Code. And you can do a little bit of research on the net square inches of opening per lineal foot of vent, etc., and make sure that your system then works correctly.
Great. Thanks for that call, David. And let's go next to Kim in Hinckley, Minnesota. Hi, Kim.
Hi. I actually am just driving through Minnesota listening to your broadcast, and I have a geothermal system in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I just wanted to comment that one of the reasons that we bought it was because we don't think we'll be there that long, and the idea of the resale value of having the geothermal for anybody who knows anything about efficiency, it will be a big plus for resale value.
Interesting.
How's
and
it?
Then my... Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, how are your bills?
Oh, they're so incredibly low. Well, we come from Duluth, Minnesota, down to Sioux Falls, and we didn't have air conditioning, of course, in Duluth, but we had heat, and we divided it year-round electric heat was $400 a month when they just divided it out for us so that our winter bills wouldn't be so crazy, compared to right now, $68 to $80 a month.
Wow.
Because we do have the system that heats the water heater as well. So we have two water heaters, one for overflow heat.
That preheats it, and then you have the other one that just tweaks it.
So we have all of that value as well. So I was just commenting that the resale value of our home will be, you know, anybody who looks at things, all things being equal, you would choose our house.
That's a good point, Kim, because it's a comparison between the cost now and the value over time. And some people feel that the cost now is more important, but really the value over time, I think, is... I use the analogy of the shoes. You buy a comfortable pair of expensive shoes, and they're going to be so much better for the life of the shoe.
Right.
Than if
and
you
the
buy
life
it.
Of your foot.
Exactly. And then my question was, the one thing that they didn't do, and I don't even know if it's possible, we just have a smallish driveway, and I had wondered if it would have been possible or if it is possible to extend your geothermal coils onto your driveway or underneath your driveway or your sidewalk areas so that in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, there isn't as much snow, but there is a bit of ice. And there's
self-cleaning driveway and sidewalks.
So you don't have a 16-year-old son to do this. Shoveling for you.
No, we don't have a 15-year-old son. But, you know, because I'm out there, and, you know, it's just like an inch to an inch and a half of snow, and it's not even worth getting the snowblower out. But, you know, I'm out there shoveling. It's not that I can't use the exercise, but I thought, I wonder if that can be extended out into that area, if it's feasible or if it is a waste of that energy or if it's just energy that would just be put out there, used for that efficiency, and then... You know, if it's not any bigger cost.
That's a great question. And, you know, I have to say that yes to all of those. It can be done. You can't really do it with the system that you have unless you modify it, because the system is designed for your house, not for your house and driveway. Does it look like you're going to be replacing your driveway anytime soon?
Well, it is cracking up, and I don't know, you know, whether it would be worthwhile for us to add it to ours, but I just thought it would be interesting to anybody else looking
sure.
out there, listening to the broadcast.
I don't really know. I don't really know what the payback would be on it.
It's an intriguing idea, though.
Grab my snowblower, I feel like I should do this something like that.
That's a great idea.
So good luck. I would talk to the person that that installed the unit and see what their input is on it, because they might be able to tell you a little more detail.
Thanks for that call, Kim, and for putting that wonderful idea in our heads of a self-cleaning driveway and sidewalks. I could get behind that.
Yeah.
Kathy in Portage is next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Two things. Just related to that last call.
Mm-hmm.
Out at Cascade Mountain ski area, they do use circulating water for melting the snow on the walkways.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
But the question that I had is, years ago, back in the 70s, when I was working in solar energy, there was a program called ACES at the University of Tennessee, where there was a huge like cistern insulated in the basement underground of one of their buildings that was filled with water. They would use that for heating in the winter with, you know, heat pumps, and then would use it, turning that to a block of ice and use it for cooling in the summer. Is there anything of that sort that's going on these days?
John?
Well, I think that's it sounds like that's what Mike was contemplating with his wood stove and boiler. But yes, the in-ground water storage systems aren't much different than the pond-type systems that were mentioned in the Fond du Lac school. And so there are a lot of ways of storing heat, and water glycol mixtures are one very efficient way of doing it.
And Ken?
I was just, yeah, I was going to say the same thing.
Okay. Great minds think alike, right? All right.
Thanks,
Kathy. And let's go to Paul in West Bend. Hi, Paul.
Hello, Judith and guests. Just wanted to pass on some information to some of your listeners. I'm associated with Friends of La Claron Nature Conservancy in West Bend, and we're currently building a 3,200-square-foot learning center that's going to be heated and cooled with a geothermal system. And the electricity is going to be provided with a 25-kilowatt photovoltaics mm-hmm. to run the entire system.
Excellent.
And since it's part of the West Bend City Parks, it will be open for the public for a demonstration site.
Great.
So we could go out there and we could take a look at how the system is functioning. And you're basically off grid there, aren't you?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
The entire conservancy is supposed to run on our 25 kW photovoltaics. We are still in the process of building. It's matter of fact, they just completed a couple of weeks ago putting in geothermal loops along the edges of our wetlands, and the building won't be completed until around December.
Mm-hmm.
So if anyone's interested, they can come out and check out the progress or go to our website at laclaron.org and track the progress there.
Great. Thanks so much for that, Paul. I think it's really great when people can see, you know, people can get excited about hearing about the theory behind things, but it's really great to be able to see how it really gets put into practice. Great. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Jim in Menominee next. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I'm calling from Menominee here, and we have a geothermal system that we installed in our house back in 1992, so it's been working wonderfully since for about 20 years now. And it was installed by Water Source Heating and Cooling out of Eau Claire. They seem to really know their stuff and have done a good job. I've got a question for you. You refer to tapping the ground source with drilling a well.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if by well you mean what we have in our yard here, which is a closed loop, actually. It's not a water well like people normally think of as getting into the groundwater.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Ken?
Yeah. No, it's dug exactly the same way as you would dig a well for your groundwater. But instead of the tube going down and into the aquifer and then basically pumping water out, it's a closed loop that's installed.
Right.
So right. that's the way that's installed. So it doesn't. That's where the similarity ends.
Okay.
And that's for a vertical well rather than a horizontal.
Yeah, four of those vertical closed loop shafts. I just want to make sure that people understood that you're not pumping water out.
No.
Right.
There are open loop systems out there. I don't know anybody in the area that's installed one, so I know that some exist.
It's a waste of water.
And yes. Jim, did you say that you've had yours since 1992?
Since 1992.
So 20 years this year.
20 years. This last winter in the coldest months, our electric bill was between $180 and $200 a month, but that includes the heating, hot water, lighting, you know, everything. Mm-hmm.
That sounds great. What kind of problems have you had with it?
Initially, the circuit breaker was not large enough.
So they undersized the circuit?
They undersized the breaker, and... Mm-hmm.
That's easily fixable.
That was easily fixed. About 6 or 7 years ago, I'm going to say they had to replace the compressor.
That's reasonable life expectancy, 18 years?
Yeah.
Pretty
15
good.
Years,
15.
We usually figure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
And,
great.
It's kept up very well. It's got a... electric coil in the plenum as a backup.
To supplement, mm-hmm.
But even in the coldest months, it never runs. Sometimes I just intentionally run it just to make sure things work and you know, burns off any dust on the coil. So
yeah, it's like firing up your snowblower in July.
Right, right.
Just to make sure.
Yeah, I did a lot of research on this before we put in the system and attended some seminars put on by one of the kind of a Canadian this old house guy. Did a seminar for builders in Minneapolis, and
great.
There were three things that were very important. And first of all, make sure that your house is sealed well, really tight. You know, which is pretty important.
Mm-hmm.
And second thing important when you're planning and building is put in as much insulation as you can. And because the house is so tight and well insulated, one thing that's really important is that you need an air exchange system.
Yes.
Or you're going to have mold problems, and the house is going to, you know, decay from the inside from dampness and mold. And we've done all three, and we've been really happy with it for 20 years.
Great. And John, did you have a comment?
That sounds like Joel Stillbrick, because I remember him giving those seminars way, way, way back when. He did a lot of good design work in Canada before he started Cambridge Building Science. And still one of the foremost authorities in the United States on heating, cooling, dehumidification.
And it's interesting, Jim was saying, you know, that they've had the system for 20 years. I mean, they're not very common now. How common were they back then?
Even less so.
Even less so, yeah. That's what I was guessing. So was that kind of an early adopter being 20 years ago?
Well, yeah, in modern day, I mean, people have been using... the heat from the ground for a lot of things, even cool from the ground. You think of wine caves as a natural form of geothermal use. So, but in the recent history of our heating history of our country, geothermal has been gaining momentum slowly, and right now I know people that all they do is geo.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know people like that 10 years ago.
And if people want to get more information about geothermal, what's a good place to send them?
Well, statistics on payback is certainly Department of Energy. I mean, the key thing is to do what Jim did. Find somebody knowledgeable and look at the entire house. I mean, Ken and I have talked about site specificity, both as far as your yard and as far as the insulation of your house. Jim put together an entire program, researched intelligently, and he's had 20 years of great service.
Thanks.
Great. And we are at the end of our talk with Ken Adams and John Freiberger. As always, guys, thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk, we will be talking about daylilies with folks from the Wisconsin Daylily Society. I hope you'll tune in for that and stay tuned to the Ideas Network. Lots more great programming coming up. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.